facts and information about forensics. You need Dean Beards, a recognized private investigator, speaker, author, and your host for Facts and Forensics. You're listening to GIMG.TV, the Global Investigator Media Group. Now here is your host, Dean Beards.
Hello and welcome back to Facts and Forensics, this podcast. I'm your host, Dean Beards, and we're here at GIMG.TV, and I'm also here with my wife, Karen.
Hello, everyone.
So we're going to talk about, of course, as we always do, some legislative topics, some events going on in our profession, things going on for us, but we always have our conversations with Karen. So real quick, tell me what we're going to talk about with that.
Well, we're going to talk about two things. One is related to a photo that we have on our website regarding the topic murder or suicide. It's just like a cartoon picture that shows a person who is deceased. And then the other thing we're going to talk about is that every contact leaves a trace.
Oh, Edmund Locard's theory.
Yes.
Okay. Well, they'll both be interesting. They've been in our most two recent newsletters. And on our blog, and we'll put those in the show notes. And we also talked about this at one of the local post-high school trade schools on that subject for the murder or suicide. Well, great. Well, stay tuned, folks. I'll be right back, and we'll talk about some news of our profession and legislative news, and then we'll have conversations with Karen.
See you then.
So, of course, I always like to bring the latest news that we have in our legislative front from the National Council of Investigation and Security Services, for which I'm the board chairman and past president, very honored with those. But before I talk about those, I first want to share with our listeners some of the commentary that we have on our blog and in our newsletter that you can take a look at recently. First of all, we have our investigator ethics involving social media. And that's an important one that primarily Karen worked on, and we're certainly recommending that you take a look at that. Some people believe that having contact on social media with particularly a person represented by an attorney is okay, but there are some things you need to be aware of, especially states that are taking issues on that in the ethics, which, as you may know in our profession, and if not, as a reminder, ethics are just as good as any statute or regulations. We need to follow those in order to protect our licenses and working for attorneys to protect theirs. We always work under the same ethics as an attorney when we're working as their agent. The other things we have on our blog and our newsletter recently, we have a guest commentary, does drug addiction increase the chance of suicide? As you know, Karen and I are very big on trying to do our best to make people aware of suicide and prevention. It's sad when we get those cases. We get a lot of them, but it's important to keep up on that. And drug addiction is high on the increase, especially with overdoses, accidental overdoses being a lead. But we also have to put the two together for leading to suicide as well as suicide by overdose. And another one we have is from way back in 2011, but you might want to take a look at it. It was a newspaper article written when we lived in our previous home and our experiences with working with families, and that's called the LaPorte, where we used to live. LaPorte investigative team takes pride in helping victims. So please take a look at that, and you'll find out a lot about what we do. And finally, one of the other things we took a look at back in 2011 was statement analysis, how much does a statement reveal? And in this particular commentary, we take a presidential campaign candidate and look at a statement that was made by a person making allegations against them, and we review a specific part of that statement to determine if there's any likelihood of validity. So you might want to take a look at that. And one of the things that's always top on our blog is one recent one, time is money. And we give several key points to ways that you can streamline your time, better your resources, save money, and also actually impress your clients with some of your being more efficient in the way you conduct business. So take a look at that always. It's a very helpful tool. And, of course, in our newsletter, we always share information from our associations, the key associations we belong to, as well as others. So go take a look at that. In case you're wondering, our newsletter is on our agency website. That's casereview.com, and just look on the navigation bar for newsletters, and you'll be able to look at the current as well as all the archived newsletters. We do one a month, and we usually post a commentary about once a month. In conversation with Karen, as she mentioned, we're going to talk about one of those. We also have some interesting articles we always put in our newsletter, so I encourage you to take a look at those. Remarkable ways that guns can be linked to a crime scene, take a look at that. It's important. When DNA implicates the innocent, in-person versus telephone investigative interviews, when opioid addicts find an ally in blue, and the law and science of eyewitness identification. These are articles that are provided by other investigators that we'd like to share the knowledge of our colleagues as well. So to the legislative front, for NCISS, it's been kind of quiet. Right now, Congress is working on issues with the new administration under President Trump and basically health care, tax reform, the economy, things like that. However, there is always issues that we have involving investigations, GPS and drones, privacy, records access, things like that. Recently, we've had NCISS has issued a call to action from our advocate in Washington, D.C., lobbyist. This call to action is available at the NCISS website, and I'll put a show note link in there. You'll want to take a look at that under important news at the NCISS.org website. Basically, this is a Senate bill with a House support that would help us in getting some acceptable language in a new GPS bill. The GPS bill right now would prohibit the use of GPS by private investigators as well as other persons, and we want a language in there that would allow for an exemption for legitimate purposes, those that would be both legal and ethical, and similar to those that we find in the Driver's Protection Privacy Act and those that were adopted specifically by the state of North Carolina and their association, which we greatly appreciate their help in putting this together. So that's just some of the latest. There's some other legislative news important to security officers and agencies regarding union shop votes, things like that, so take a look at that. And we always like to tell you some of the top five things to look for for investigators. That's the quintessential investigator. So we encourage you to take a look at that. As I mentioned, I'm going to have, after conversation with Karen, I'm going to be talking with Brandon Perrin about his forensic testimony evidence recovery, FTER, and a special event that he's going to be having coming up here in September. So stay tuned after conversations with Karen and listen for that, and we'll be right back.
Death Investigation, distance learning for private investigators. We are pleased and excited to announce that this distance learning course has been adapted by several professional associations as a benefit to their members. These associations offer course discounts to their members and receive a donated portion of the proceeds. If your association is interested, please have them contact us. There is no cost or obligation to add this valuable member benefit and revenue sharing opportunity. Course details can be found at medicolegaldeathinvestigations.com and includes an opportunity for continuing education approved in 17 states through pieducation.com.
And you can reach our agency, Associates in Forensic Investigations. We consult on expertly nationwide, based in Colorado and Wyoming. You can reach us at 970-480-7793 or our new Wyoming number at 307-222-0136. And our website is deathexperts.com. Hello and welcome back to Facts and Forensics at GIMD.TV. We're here with our conversations with Karen.
Hello again.
So when we started out with this episode, you mentioned that we had a couple things to talk about. One of them was this cartoon-like photograph that we had in one of our newsletters. I think it was our June newsletter, Murder or Suicide. So tell us a little bit about that first, and we'll put this on our show notes or the link so you guys can go look at it and share your comments as well.
Right. It's just basically a cartoon, and it shows what appears to be a female that is deceased, and the female has a gun in her hand.
And there's some other components in this photograph, and our listeners aren't going to be able to really get much with that, so what I'd suggest you do is stop the podcast here and go to our website, deathcasereview.com, look under our blog or newsletters, it's both places, and look up, I think we have it actually titled Homicide or Suicide, because that's how we rate our manners of death. Murder is a legal term. And then come back, and then you can kind of follow us along on that. I think that's a good idea. So go ahead and pause, come back, and then unpause. So tell us a little bit about the theory behind one of these types of examples.
Well, when you first walk into a scene, you know, you see a person laying there with a gun in their hand. There's blood spatter on the wall. There's a stool turned over. She has one shoe that's visible. She could be laying on the other shoe. There's all types of different. I know somebody brought up that the lamp's unplugged. I don't know what that could have been unplugged when she fell. There's a cigarette in her hand. It doesn't show smoke, so we don't know if it's lit. And there's a note. We can't see what the note says, but it looks like there's a pair of glasses there and a pen and a paper. It looks like she was writing a note. So there's different things going on in this little cartoon.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. Reading glasses, the windows show some darkness. So people have commented on the original site that we went back and found this at and on our own website, our blog. For example, it's dark out and the light's unplugged, so it must have been unplugged. But one of the first things is we really don't know what time this happened.
No.
We just know that this photograph, as it might be, was taken when it was supposed to be dark outside. Some have mentioned the glasses are reading glasses. We don't know. They could be. And maybe a person took them off because they were done reading or writing. There is that note. Some have said the position of the note is for a right-handed person. But to be honest, if you watch left-handed people write, it's the same thing. Yeah. What other things have you heard people mention?
Oh, they mention the fact that they think the gun is in the wrong hand for the blood spatter. And then the fact that she's holding a cigarette. I'd say that's the oddest thing, is that she's holding a cigarette, probably.
Yeah, that is odd. At the trade school that we spoke at, that was one of the things mentioned. And because it's between her index finger and her middle finger, of her left hand.
Like handgun, people are smoking.
Right, just like you normally would hold it. So there is one shoe or sandal there. Some have said that the handgun in her right hand is the wrong hand for the blood spatter on the wall, which the blood spatter on the wall, for those that can't look at the picture, is to the right of the image. She's sitting at sort of a desk shelf. But the stool's knocked over, and if she were sitting on the stool facing a certain way, then the blood spatter would be fine.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know.
And we don't know, you know, there's all different ways a person can hold a firearm, so.
Yeah, and position themselves. They can turn their head,
right.
Turn their body, you know, up or down and backwards. I had lunch with one of the forensic pathologists that trained us, and we weren't talking about this, we were talking about other things, but he mentioned that what people don't understand is any way you can move your head or body and put a gun to that wound is plausible.
Yes.
It's the other circumstances that are important. So, what would we need to continue if we were given a case like this? And we have had investigators send us a photo or an attorney say, what do you think of this? You know, and we're like, well.
That's not enough information. That's the whole point to this exercise is that's not enough information. You don't want to conclude much of anything at this point by looking at this photo.
And what are the things you
other than the fact the person is deceased?
That early set, yeah, we're pretty clear on that. I mean, if we really want to get technical, I would say that the person is deceased, but maybe the paramedics haven't been there because there's no indication that there's leads for them to check for life, which we often saw when we walked in. But one of the first things you said was when you first walk into a scene is what this picture's showing. But that was interesting because when you do first walk into a scene, what do you do?
Well, you assess the scene. You look at everything that's going on in the scene.
And looking at everything going on, we try to absorb it. And one of the one things we don't do, like you mentioned, is we don't assume something did or didn't happen.
Correct.
I mean, you said it a little bit differently, but that's, you know, you were explaining a little more detail, but that's what, you know, what we need to do. We don't know if there was one person in here or more than one person. We don't know if a scuffle took place. We don't know if that's a suicide note in this picture. We don't know the time of day.
And, you know, it could be that her cigarettes were her best friend and she just wanted to hold on to it. Who knows?
You know, and people think you're joking, but actually you're serious because
yes.
We have seen people that are holding on to something dearly, their addiction or whatever the case may be. I mean, we've literally seen people holding marijuana pipes,
mm-hmm.
Needles, cigarettes, things
pill
like
bottles.
That, notes, pictures, pill bottles.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know. So what are some of the things we would need to carry this investigation a little further?
Well, you would need an autopsy for one thing, and you would need to talk to people close to her, or I'm not sure if it's a male or a female.
Well, I know we look at the picture, and the assumption is a female based on just in general, but anatomically there's basically breasts are missing that
yes.
help us indicate. So I guess in this fluid society, maybe we don't know.
No, we don't know. But anyway, we would need to talk to family and friends, and find out about her work. There's a lot of conversation that needs to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you mentioned autopsy first. Talking to people, witnesses, information. I mean, that's the thing, is we have one piece of information as a picture, but a lot of information within it. But if we're standing at the scene, there's a lot more that we would absorb and we would need to do in order to do this. And one of the things, this reminds me of like the CSI-type TV shows.
Right.
Where somebody walks in and they've got it solved. And that's not how this works.
Well, yeah, it's not how it works. It's not how it's supposed to work either. We do know some people make mistakes by coming in and just making a statement, and they could be very wrong.
They could very well be. A lot of evidence would be collected from here. A lot of
Definitely.
Photographs would be taken. But you mentioned autopsy. One of the first things that comes to mind for an autopsy that we would need to know is it would tell us what type of gunshot wound, assuming there's a gunshot wound. We actually don't know if the gun's been fired.
No.
I mean, we know we have blood spatter
yes.
on the wall, but we don't know that gun in the photograph has been fired.
No.
Maybe this person was defending themselves and got shot.
Who knows?
Or something. But let's just assume that that's the handgun, just for the sake of argument. But the gunshot wound itself, we would know the trajectory, which would depend on the rest of the body position, but we would know the entrance, and if there's an exit, which we assume there's an exit from the blood spatter, we would know if it's contact or mid-range or distant, you know, things like that. What else would we learn from autopsy?
Well, they would definitely do the toxicology, take samples, blood samples, samples of tissue and run the tox to see if what kind of medication or illegal drugs or
yeah, there could be illegal drugs as well as legal drugs, alcohol. There's a what looks to be a Coca-Cola can. We don't know what's in it or not in it, but
how we know people that walk around with a Coca-Cola can and they've got it full of whiskey.
Yep, we do. I think we probably all do at some point somehow. But yeah, mental health related prescriptions, things like that.
That's important.
Prescription drugs that they don't have a prescription for. So yeah, toxicology, gunshot, other injuries comes to mind. Was there a scuffle or anything like that?
Right.
You know, maybe medical history. So yeah, I think the important thing that our listeners and hopefully looking at this photograph as well with us needs to take away from this is, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words, but it still doesn't answer the questions.
It doesn't answer the questions, and the words may be incorrect as to what they're, you know, coming up with. So the moral of the story is never assume, never make a quick judgment of what's going on in a scene.
True. Last thing I'll point out is that this also tells us how important photographs are because our listeners are trying to get an idea of what we're talking about, and if they're not looking at the image, it's difficult.
They don't know.
We have that difficulty reading reports.
And that happens, too. I mean, it's the whole picture the whole case file is what is important. You've got the photos, you have the reports, coroner's reports, police reports. So all of it comes together.
All the records, reports, and photographs come together. That's definitely true. Well, let's move on to our next thing you wanted to talk about. Well, remind me of what that was again.
It's that every contact leaves a trace.
Oh, Edmund Lockhart's theory. Yeah, this came to us as a video from a London police officer from our friends Phil and Ian Johnson at J&J Associates International. They're based over in Portugal. They take care of England and things like that. But this is a YouTube video. The link will be on there. It's interesting to look at. This officer, it got our attention when he's talking about how, as a police officer, he uses Lockhart's theory for their investigations, but we kind of take it, which is very true, we take it further than that. But Edmund Lockhart, just real quick for our listeners, was the first criminalist or criminal scientist, and he had the first crime lab in Lyon, France. And he concluded that every time two people or a person in a place or a person in a thing contact, they leave something behind and take something with them. So you might leave trace evidence, hair, fibers, tool marks, DNA now, fingerprints, things like that. So what's important for our listeners to understand about what this about Lockhart's theory and how it works in our everyday and professional lives and how we use it?
Well, that can go with everything, and as has been mentioned, even when we have conversation, we are giving something and we're also taking away from a conversation.
That's a good point. That's a very good point, especially in our interviews. That's what happens. But you mentioned, to go back to that picture, that we would have to interview people. And so how does that relate to that, interviewing people with every contact, to interviewing witnesses?
Well, it's the same principle. When you talk to someone, you're finding out information and you're leaving them with, they may not even realize, you know, what's been going on with this person as well. So you're exchanging information, which is the same principle as when you talk, you know, when you come into a scene, you're leaving traces of yourself there as you walk away, you're taking something from the scene.
And that happens, like I said, with witnesses. They may have had conversation with them, and we have our interviews and conversations with those witnesses to help fill in those gaps. What about in people's, how does that expand to other investigations that we're involved in and other investigators should be involved in?
Well, it goes for every investigation. Even at conferences, you're learning, and they're learning from you as well.
That's true. when you go to continuing education and stuff like that, often the instructor shares information with you, which is your reason for going there, but I'm sure the instructors walk away having learned something from their...
Well, you would
attending.
Hope,
yeah.
Unless they're, you know, the type of people that think they can't learn anything, and there's plenty of those out there. But what's interesting is the DNA and how it can... you say we shake hands, and then we're trading DNA, and then I go shake hands with somebody else. I've taken a little bit of your DNA and my DNA, and I'm connecting with that other person.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's something that people really
don't
understand.
They don't get it.
Is when this contact leaves, a trace continues. If you go verbally, that's sort of like gossip.
Right.
Things might change. But one of the things about this trace evidence is it just indicates that a person may or may not have been there. And I say may for the very reason you just did.
Right.
Because we don't know how that DNA got there.
You know, there was that show that we saw where I believe they were cousins. They were fishing. And then I think a little far down the river there was a murder happened or homicide happened.
Right.
I can't remember what.
With a vehicle and everything.
With a vehicle. Mm-hmm. And they both claimed they were not there. And the strange thing is the officers that came and talked to them shook both of their hands and touched the one on the shoulder. And then there was two places on the vehicle
right. That
had DNA of these two people.
But they weren't, and it was proven they weren't there.
And the funny thing, the strange thing, not funny, it's strange that where it shows that the one officer where he has his hand, that is exactly
where they found that DNA.
Where they found the DNA of the
other person. That. That's a very good point. And there's several things that comes with. I say may for that reason. We know it's there. And even if we know that the person's been there and left that evidence themselves, such as a fingerprint, which can be transferred, but they're much harder to transfer. Hair can be transferred just by me catching my hair on your shirt and then you going somewhere else
yep. In
your car. Well, that doesn't mean I was in your car.
No.
I have been in your car, but that doesn't mean I was in your car. But let's just say I was in your car, but now it doesn't say when I was in your car.
Mm-mm.
Or why.
No.
Or where was your car at? Where did this take? So when we do our investigations, and everybody, this isn't unique to us, this is a basic concept, is we need to connect everything. We need to connect the scene to the victim, the scene to the perpetrator, any instrument used in the crime to the scene, the perpetrator and the victim, and all those around it in the triangle. That's important. So I guess this contact leaves a trace really is something that, and there's great books out there on criminalistics and everything that would explain all this, but unfortunately the TV shows, movies, things like that, they hang on this idea that if it's there, then
they
this
did
person
it.
Did it,
mm-hmm.
and even if they have an alibi, that did, you know, that's one thing. This reminds me of Lieutenant John Priest, retired from Denver PD. We've seen him a few times. I've seen him a lot. He's an expert consultant now, and very good at what he does. He had one of the very first DNA cases in Denver and one of the first in the country. And it's a long story, but basically a lady was killed. She had she was a white lady. She had a black boyfriend, and they had information from the scene evidence that indicated that the suspect was black. From DNA, and they had other evidence, and they found in a nearby dumpster, they found how she was beat and clothing and things like this. To make a very long, hour-long presentation short, he followed from suspect to suspect and kept ruling them out, not just by DNA, because he was still waiting on that to come back, but by their alibis and sizes and things like that. And, for example, a piece of clothing was found that was worn by the suspect. That was known. That was determined. That's where some DNA was. But that didn't belong to who it was registered to at a nearby halfway house.
Hmm.
or it did, but it wasn't, but that's not who the DNA belonged to. And then ultimately they found the right person in another state after they went through three or four suspects, and he was actually literally trying to steal an entire cash register from a convenience store. But he kept ruling him out from one thing to another. But if he would have done things the way some TV shows show, the very first suspect would have been arrested and convicted.
Right, and probably would have been her boyfriend.
And, well, actually, they ruled him out kind of quick. He was actually sleeping in the next room. He had slept through the entire beating, which he was a suspect. But who sleeps through an entire beating?
Wasn't that the woman that was, she was outside, she wasn't in the house? Or was that a different one?
No, that was a different one because she was in the living room. And there was another story. There was a teacher
similar,
that was found outside that was similar too. Yeah, it was also Lieutenant Priest talked about that case as well. So that's an important case. I'll have to look up some of that, see if I can find some notes I can put for our listeners on that story. Maybe I'll get a hold of him and see if he'll share something that I, a link or something I can use. So maybe I'll even have Lieutenant Priest on here as a guest. That might be a good idea. He can talk about that. Because it's very interesting, and when you follow the stories he tells, you keep going, oh, they got him. And then he would come and tell you, nope, we found out it wasn't him, and it was just honest, solid, hard police work that did that from one thing to the other. And it was interesting. Ultimately, the DNA proved the suspect, but they had to use other evidence to prove the suspect was there at that time and committed that crime. All the DNA did was prove that suspect. And it actually eliminated other suspects. But, through, again, other circumstances that they had to do. Well, that's very good. That's very interesting. Before we close our episode of Conversation with Karen, what else do you have for us?
Well, I can't think of anything right
now. Okay. Well, we're doing this every other month. Tim's doing his show every other month. It just kind of makes things better for our listeners. We appreciate you staying tuned with us. Hang on for a moment, and I'll be right back with our special guest, Brandon Perrin. He's going to talk about an event we have in coming to Colorado and certification with interviewing. And by the way, I just want to tell you that everything we've talked about so far connects, and we actually have some of that connection when I talk to Brandon. So thanks a lot, and thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Survivor's Guide to Understanding Death Investigation. We are pleased to announce the release of our latest book, A Survivor's Guide to Understanding Death Investigations. This was developed for those to help those who have lost a loved one to understand the maze and complexities and protocols of official death investigations. We often hear from families, attorneys, investigators, and funeral homes with families looking for where to turn and just trying to understand how the death of a loved one was or should have been properly investigated. Families are just simply seeking closure through answers. You can learn more at the book website, www.understandingdeathinvestigations.com.
You can reach us at 970-480-7793 or 307-222-0136, and always our website at deathexperts.com.
As a finder of fact, private investigators review extensive materials during the course of civil and criminal investigations. Today we will focus on those cases benefited by a criminal offense investigator and the evidence applied to our justice system. This will focus on a method I highly recommend to our listeners to become familiar with and involved with for criminal defense. Our Constitution includes certain rights to a criminal defendant, including an investigator. My friend and colleague Brandon Perrin is a Florida-based investigator and expert in this important field. This will certainly be another informative segment. As you might recall, Brandon was with us before, where he talked about the Certified Defense Investigator Training Council and or Criminal Defense Investigation Training Council and the Certified Criminal Defense Investigator certification that they provide that's very helpful to not only how you conduct criminal defense investigations, but working with your clients and gaining clients and market share, as well as your rates. But like I said, this time he's going to be talking about forensic testimonial evidence recovery, FTER. and a special event coming up in September. So a little bit as a reminder of Brandon, he is an award-winning, nationally recognized private investigator. He is a board-certified criminal defense investigator and has qualified as an expert in criminal investigation by the court. Mr. Perrin has over 25 years of investigative experience as a former U.S. Air Force criminal investigator, State of Florida public defender investigator, government-appointed civil and human rights investigator, and Florida-licensed private investigator. He is recognized as one of the nation's foremost private investigators, trainers, and speakers in the area of criminal defense investigation. Mr. Perrin authored the industry-acclaimed book, quote, Uncovering Reasonable Doubt, The Component Method, end quote, as well as the novel for the title being The Quest for the Truth, which, by the way, Brandon has shared with me. That's a very good book. It's fiction, but don't quite take it that way. I think you can take it as an analogy to the times that we have learned and lived in, and I think it's some great philosophical information in there and anecdotal information. That's just my notes. In addition, Brandon has received multiple awards and commendations and has earned his associate's and bachelor's degrees in criminal justice administration and has graduated from numerous military and civilian advanced investigative training schools and programs. Ms. Perrin is also the Strategic Operations Director for Case in Point Services in the Boston area and maintains investigative consulting and director positions with the Office of the Public Defender, 19th Judicial Circuit, State of Florida, and the Office of Criminal Conflict and Civil Regional Counsel, 4th District, State of Florida. So without further ado, we're going to bring Brandon in and welcome him as we talk about FTER and that special event coming up. Welcome, Brandon.
Well, hey, Brandon. Thanks for coming back here on Facts and Forensics at GING.TV. You heard our introduction to our listeners there. So why don't we start with sharing some of your contact information and just kind of telling our members or listeners a little hi.
Well, great. I appreciate it, Dean. Always enjoy coming on the show with you and talking. No problem. Again, Brandon Perrin, board-certified criminal defense investigator, certified forensic interviewer in the FTER method, and I'm the National Director of the Criminal Defense Investigation Training Council, Stuart, Florida. I'm also the Director and Owner of Investigative Support Specialists Incorporated, which is a private investigation agency that does training, consulting for the government, and investigative assignments for all parties, business, industry, and government as well. My contact information for websites, first would be for the CDITC, is cditctraining.com. or publicdefenderinvestigator.com. And my other website would be investigation.us.com. And you can reach us at 1-800-465-5233, 1-800-465-5233.
Great. That's very helpful.
That's a lot of information I gave you. And I'm an Aquarian. I don't know if that would help.
And I wish you to know. I'll put this in the show notes so they'll be able to look on the website for it. But, you know, hey, you got a lot of information you got to share with us, and that's what's important here today. You know, we certainly look forward to that. You know, we've talked before. You know, it's been a little while since we've had you on the show, and it's just I know we're busy and it's been hard to get you back, but we have a couple reasons for doing today's show. But the past show, which I'll link on the show notes to the old show, our listeners learned about the CCDI method, the Certified Criminal Defense Investigator a method from you, and I touched then on the new certification you have, the FTER, and I'm going to let you further explain. I touched on it in the introduction here, but I'm going to let you explain a little more about that. But there's a important reason why we're bringing that up for this show, and that's because of a training opportunity we're going to talk about in Colorado that you're going to present that. But first, tell our listeners, you know, about the FTER method and how you developed it and what it means. And we'll go from there.
One of the things, you know, that the FTER method was basically forensic. It stands for Forensic Testimonial Evidence Recovery. And it's I don't want to say it's just a forensic interviewing method because it's much more than interviewing. What the FTER method does, it provides the investigator with a comprehensive approach to testimonial evidence in general, in all of its forms, in every way that we encounter it. So it's, you know, and many times you can learn forensic interviewing methods depending on the process. There's forensic interviewing for child interviews. There's different forensic methods that have been taught, you know, arguably forensic methods taught through the Reed technique and all. And they're all designed for a certain purpose. And they're often technique and I would say sometimes even tricks of the trade that you can use to get people to tell them what you need to hear, what you need them to tell you, or to recover certain facts from them, or and hopefully at the end of the day recover the truth. But as investigators, especially specializing in criminal defense investigation, my experience has found that we have to be experts experts in testimonial evidence across the board, not just in the form of interviewing people. Look how many police reports we review and we
right.
I want to say analyze that we subject to our own analysis. How many statements, how many transcripts we have to read, forensic reports, everything, every document that's ever created for a case which is supposed to reflect evidence. And much of the evidence reflected in those reports is testimonial evidence. You know, our system is so used, as you're an expert in forensic science evidence, and we're so used to having experts analyze physical evidence that I think that we've really dropped the ball when it comes to testimonial evidence, when we consider the impact that testimonial evidence has on a case, on a courtroom, on a jury.
I think that's absolutely true, and one of the things you mentioned is the Reid technique. And that's designed for basically eliciting a confession.
Yes.
And
I took the technique in 87. Yeah. It's specifically focused, and it's for a confession for the purpose of being a confession. It's not designed. Its whole methodology is not based upon recovering the truth.
Right.
It, as you said, it's designed to facilitate the recovery of a confession. And
right.
They may be two different things.
And police reports, on the other hand, are and the interview technique, which we know is heavily based and trained on Reid, but they're designed strictly to obtain the elements of the crime.
Yes, recover the facts that meet the elements of crime, case done, and even in that standard, they're looking for probable cause to make the arrest. How many
right.
detectives do you know? How many police officers, line officers do you know? I know, being a former officer myself, that we were really trained to pursue evidence that would prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the suspect is guilty. No, we were taught to recover probable cause, justify
exactly.
the arrest.
And that's all it's for. And, of course, in our work, as you mentioned, you know, we're taught to analyze those, whether it be an interview transcript, an interview recording, or police reports, and glean that information out. But at the same time, the whole purpose of our investigations is to get to the truth, or at least the best of it that we can. And that's where your FTER method, your forensic testimonial evidence recovery method, comes into play. And I've looked at the book, and I need you to mention how listeners can get that. And you can apply that technique as well as your component method to recovering information, not just in, as you mentioned, not just in interviews, but just recovering that information, which is important.
So many facts, exculpatory facts, for example, can be found just buried within a law enforcement investigation. They may not have
right.
been emphasized. They may not have been put in the arrest affidavit or in the primary reports, but they are often there in written statements and recorded statements and transcripts and field interview reports and canvassing sheets. And we really have to learn to organize the information and subject it to analysis. You know, what we try to do in the FTR method is teach people to do more than just merely read a report like they're reading a newspaper or a magazine. We can't read that. We're trained to read a certain way that our mind even skips words and looks for, certain meat of a sentence. Well, we don't have that luxury in investigation. We can't do that. We've got to read, we teach to analyze the information, a report, from top to bottom, line by line, page by page. And then we have to look for inconsistencies and discrepancies and errors
yes.
and omissions and flaws. And then we have to reconcile these inconsistencies, discrepancies, errors, omissions, and flaws and mistakes with other information that can be found in the rest of the case and other documents. You know, if it doesn't reconcile, why not? Why is it not corroborated? Why is it not consistent? You know, and this is something we have to do. And we have to do all of this before we ever even interview a witness. And before we even get into that, one of the things we try to do in the FTR method is to make sure that an interviewer an expert in forensic testimony, forensic testimony evidence recovery. But an expert at FTR has to know that no matter where I start, if I'm going to start reviewing cases, before you can identify and clearly reconcile testimony evidence, you have to understand it at its core. How does it come to be?
Yeah.
How does it come to be? You know, how does a person, you know, it's not what they say, right? The testimony evidence starts far, long before that. When they, and some would argue, so when does testimonial evidence begin? Does it begin when a witness observes an event and then processes the event and comes to a conclusion and interpretation? No. What influences a witness happens long before that. Their biases, their prejudices, how all their experiences in life, their philosophy of life, their understanding of the world all has an impact on how they'll interpret what they observe. It all does. I like to call them the three P's. There's going to be the philosophical, and that is internal influences that can contaminate something that a person observes. And what they do is, what are their biases, their prejudices, what are their understanding of the world, how do they see the world, what do they believe is right and wrong, what is their moral code or lack of one. We will all witness an event and throw our internal interpretations upon it as we process and interpret it and then form a conclusion. And then we also have the other, one of the other P's, which I call the physical, and that's external, which would be, you know, the My Cousin Vinny stuff. You know, how far are you from the event? What obstructs line of sight? What is the field of vision? What was the available lighting, ambient lighting? Was there anything obstructing their view? What is the distance? All of these things have an impact on what you can see and what you can experience, which will, of course, in turn have an impact on your interpretation and conclusion. And then the third P is the physiological, and that we're not all made the same. As much as we are in the United States, we should be seen as equals before the law, but we're not equals. Some people have better eyesight than others. Some people have limitations on the hearing. Sometimes when we see an event or witness an event, we're exhausted, we're ill. All of these things can have an impact on our ability to process, interpret, and come to a conclusion. And as investigators, we need to understand how testimonial evidence is formed, that what made them come to, what did they use, and how did they process the experience of an event, not just seeing it, the experience of an event. How did they process it to come to this particular conclusion? And is there anything in that processing that could have had an impact to explain why? And, you know, Dean, one of the things I never ask, but I really caution those investigators who walk into an interview and say, tell me what happened. Because when you ask a witness what happened, they're going to draw from every source of information they have on that particular day, including people they've spoken to, articles they've read. I'm a big history nut, as you know. We're friends.
Yeah.
You ask me about what happened on D-Day, I'll tell you. Guess what? I wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, but I will give you a factual of account of what happened. But I did not have percipient knowledge. And we have to remember as investigators, when we ask someone what happened, we don't want to know what happened. We want to know, what did they experience? What did they see? What did they hear? Personally, and when you ask that question, go ahead.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
And when you ask a person that a question, like to say what happened, get a summary to kind of figure out where they're coming from on their own terms. How well do they articulate? How well do they put the words together? Where are they? And then you ask them, okay, so that's what happened. Tell me what you observed yourself. You will often see them think about it and edit, and then tell you something differently. Because
no, that's absolutely true. And one of the things that I find is that investigators will conduct, you know, interviews, so to speak. I don't know, they're really not interviews. And this is what's important about what you're teaching. But they'll ask that question, you know, tell me what you saw, you know, in this car accident. And then they'll tell them what they saw, and then the person will say, okay, well, thank you, I appreciate that, or, you know, can I get a statement from you? And maybe they'll formalize it, you know, with a written statement. But they don't ask those important questions to really gain or recover that evidence that they need to have. And, you know, we have several clients that, you know, have grown to expect that. They were used to one way, but we've we've given them another way that we do things, and they've come to expect that now. And it's
well, there's
very
so
helpful.
Much more. Many there's so many more questions that need to be asked in a especially if you're dealing with a criminal case or even a civil case where there is a potential for impeaching a witness, or you may even
right.
attempting to impeach this witness. You know, when I say the three P's, someone would say, "Well, why is it important? Why is their physiology important?" Well, just read the rules of evidence in every state in this union. And it'll tell you that one of the things they have to be able to do to provide testimony or else it can be impeached is they have to remember and recall. They have to be able to mm-hmm. recollect. So what if you're
right.
able to show that? Just ask the question, well, what were you doing? It was this incident happened at 2 o'clock in the morning. What were you doing before that? I was working. Oh, you work. What do you do? I work in a metal shop. Oh, how long were you working? I worked a double shift that day. So what time were you getting home? Well, it was about 1. So were you tired? Oh, I was exhausted. You know, yeah, I know sometimes you might be falling asleep at the wheel. Oh, I was so tired. Is it going to be important for an attorney to know under direct across that this particular witness at the time they made an observation was exhausted? Of course it is. Could that impact
yeah,
their ability to recollect and recall? How much did you actually see? You know, a joke I always make, Dean, is of all the cases, thousands and thousands of criminal cases I've worked in 32 years, I always say, I'll have a big incident happen in a nightclub, 2:30 in the morning, right? You got all kinds of people there. You got people at the bar. You got guests. You've got bartenders. You got bouncers. You got everybody. And the only one who's been drinking alcohol is my client. No, there is absolutely no reference to any witnesses consuming or drinking alcohol. How much did they drink? When did they start drinking? Not a damn word. Nothing. How? What? That's an important, crucial question to ask. You were at a bar. Were you consuming alcohol? If so, what? How much? When did you start? Then you can start extrapolating to if they weren't impaired at the time of their observation. But do we ever see that? Hardly ever, if ever.
No, and you mentioned in police reports, that's one of the things that you look for. You know, it's sort of like a when you take a photograph to show something negative, another something that should be there but isn't.
Yep, negative evidence, right?
It's the same thing in the interview. You know, if you're coming across reading a report or an interview and there's things that just are left out, you have to find out what they are and why.
It's not only what's there, but what's not there and why isn't it there? Because it should be based upon the other facts. So it's not
right.
just our opinion that they should bear. We're, you know, generally negative evidence from a testimony perspective is we're saying it should be there because another witness said something else happened, which would be a cause and effect. You know, mm-hmm. and so FTR basically trains the investigator to think, number one, think, not to investigate, not just document. I think when you referenced interviewing earlier, you made the point that they're not always interviewing because many people interview by just document. They ask 10 questions that were given to them by an attorney. They go out and ask the 10 questions and get no follow-up. Well, that's not an interview.
Right.
That's a direct examination. And as I always say, the difference between lawyers and investigators is a lawyer's number one rule is never ask a question they don't know the answer to. Well, that's not our rule. We ask every question, right? We ask every question that needs to be answered. We may ask it at a time that's not going to derail an otherwise productive interview. We'll ask at the end, but it's going to be asked because it has to be asked, and that's how we have that symbiotic relationship with lawyers. They can't ask a question they don't know the answer to, so what do? They retain us to go out and get the answers to the questions so now they know what to ask and what not to ask.
Exactly.
You know?
And that brings us to a good point. This is important, and this isn't something that investigators can just go get by, you know, honestly picking up your book. They need it. But we need to go through some practical issues. Experience helps, but you gain that. So let's talk about, for our listeners, what is the learning process and the certification process that's available, and we'll talk about a special opportunity here coming up, but just in general terms, what's the learning process for them to get certified?
To become certified in forensic testimony evidence recovery, we have a distance learning program. You know, we have that for that and the component method. They can do the distance learning, which is, I always say to people, if you can, the distance learning program is cost effective because you don't have to travel, but it is as comprehensive. It's actually more work. It's more work.
Okay.
It's a lot of questions, a lot of testing, and it also involves a lot of exercises that have to be recorded based upon, practicals that you have to do that have to be submitted for grading. So there's a lot of work, but it can be done at your time, at your schedule, and there's a lot of one-person shops out there in the investigation field who just don't have the time and or the funds to be able to travel to different locations to do it. That's what, that being
right.
said, the other way is to attend one of the, in-person programs that we have. We have one going on here at the end of the month with the Florida Public Defenders Association. We're doing the same program with their investigators in the state of Florida. So we have a lot of – and as you know, with the CDHC, we train a lot of public defender agencies throughout the country.
Yeah.
Probably good 40-something different states and programs that we continue to train, including the military.
When
we just trained the Marine Corps in January.
You did.
And the component method, their first set of criminal defense investigators. And we're talking to the Navy now about coming to train them at the War College. So that goes on. But in our FTR program, which will also be in Colorado with the Colorado Private Investigators Association, that's a great opportunity for people who are going to be in the Midwest or West or even on the West Coast who want to take the program. That program, it's going to be intense. I'm not going to tell anybody I don't want anybody getting surprises. We're going to be in there all day, and it's a 8-hour program, so it's 16 hours packed into 8 hours. Anybody who's sat in any one of my programs, and I just speed up the process.
But it will be intense.
It'll be a lot of information. It's going to be very fast-paced. There will be testing involved at the end of the day. You don't have to, the test is a takeaway. It's open book, and anybody who's ever taken an open book test knows they're not easy. They require work, and that test will be explained there. I don't want to give away that. And the test doesn't have to be turned in that day. It can be turned in any time over the weekend at the program or even submitted to us. We give a certain amount of days, and I forget what the amount of days is, but they can do that so they have time to study. Because when you're going to do programs, it's not enough to just sit in a program a day, listen to someone provide a lecture, and then all of a sudden you're certified. You're going to have to, listen to the program and then do some self-study as well, and there's going to be a lot of – and there's a test associated with that that's built into the book as well. There's a question and answer essay questions that you have to answer, and then also a 50-question true or false and multiple choice type question that has to be answered. Now, the good thing about Colorado is normally your fees, you pay for the certification to go to the training. And then you'd also have to pay for, which can be anywhere from $275 to $450, depending on which organization is doing it and how much of it they're picking up for their members. It depends on the organization. And in addition to that, you'd have to pay $175 for the certification application fee and $50 membership, first year's fee, and then $50 a year to maintain your certification. Well, I'm not sure who it was, but somebody beat the CDITC up on the fees. I'm pretty sure it was you. So those who are listening and are members of the Colorado organization, he's really looking out for them. And, and with all credit, you were able to negotiate that the people who take it in Colorado do not have to pay the $175 certification fee or the $50 first-year dues. That's $225 saved right there. Nor, as long as they maintain membership in the Colorado Association, and I would also throw in, as long as they maintain membership in the NCISS, they do not have to pay the CDITC $50 membership dues a year ever. They don't have to. So the cost savings of taking it in Colorado is big. And you get to see Colorado, so that's kind of a double win right there.
It's a great one, and we're going to talk about a little bit more about that. So actually, I think you owe me money for being members of both, right? But
no matter what deal I get into, I always leave owing money. I'm not sure how that happens.
Our guests, just stay tuned. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Visit us at www.gimg.tv for more show links and shows from all of our hosts.
Thanks, and now back to our guest.
In fairness to our members and our listeners, we had long talks about this, to get this program. One was, your schedule, and we wanted to fine-tune what PPIC thought would be best suited and what you thought would also be best suited, and we came up with the idea of doing the FTR program. Now, you were a little hesitant about trying to cram 2 days into one, but you mentioned that you had been able to do it successfully before with Fally and that you would do it again.
Well, and it worked real well. It was hard, yes. But we did it.
Right.
We did it.
But you did it. And you did, PPIC is picking up some things. Our listeners should know that in order to bring this at a cost, we're hoping, and I'm not a board member of PPIC, but I'm a member. I'm a past board member. But we are hoping that members or attendees stay for the other 2 days of the conference because that helps, fund you or the course so that you were able to allow us to set the fees. You didn't set the fees. You just said, this is what it's going to cost. And, you guys set your fees. So they did some number crunching and you agreed to it. And then you threw in that bone that said, okay, to make it sweeter for everybody going, I'm going to throw in that certification. And then I begged you for a little bit. And so you leaned a little more and gave me a little more. So I want to thank you for that. I think it's going to work out. I don't have our numbers yet. Marketing is still rolling and I know you're starting some. So I think we'll have some good attendance. And most important, I think people will be, leaving with something, really exciting. So I'll run through the numbers and links and they'll be on the show notes here just before the end of the show. But I did want to kind of expand a little bit on what you've been talking about. I know you've shared a lot of information, but can you share some of important examples or concepts that investigators can take away from learning this FTER method, this forensic testimony evidence recovery method? I know there's some real life examples that you've shown me, and I know some of the people personally, but just some things that might make them go, okay, this really would be good for me. I mean, what sets it apart from the way they normally do interviews? What makes it a stronger component to add to their toolbox?
Well, number one, I think the most obvious is going to be that it'll expand the amount of information they're going to garner from any interview that they engage in. And that's not only at the fact level when it comes to the facts directly related to the incident itself, but they'll immediately see an expansion as it relates to focusing on not only recovering facts regarding the event witnessed, but also the history of the event, and any kind of information that could assist in impeaching either the witness themselves or other witnesses in the case. I found that one of the big flaws we often find is that in most criminal defense cases, not only investigators not focusing on an impeachment of the state's case, the state's evidence, the state's witnesses, but the lawyers aren't doing it either. They're not really using it. Sometimes it's the only defense that's out there. How many cases are really, how many defendants are convicted on fingerprint evidence or,
right.
Prints? In the movies, they're all the time. But in reality, most defendants are going to prison and being convicted based upon testimonial evidence, which is the most flawed evidence out there. It's the most unreliable. But we can't just say that. We've got to prove it. We're investigators. We've got to prove it. So your toolbox will now be enhanced by tools, which are the skills you've developed, the knowledge you've developed, to be able to ask those additional questions that will start digging deeper to go beyond the obvious. I don't think we can just build our reputations and our careers on going after low-hanging fruit. We have to go after the difficult information, the difficult facts that's hard to get to. Sometimes we have to get a ladder and climb to it. We have to make our way up the tree, so to speak, to get to the truth. And that's what this will do. And that's just in the interviewing process. So in addition to that, I think it's fun. I've had some colleagues who have talked about how it's helped them, which is, I shared the experience, is just your ability to make part of your investigation component is to put more emphasis in the forensic case review and analysis. That is, reviewing the evidence that is the police reports, that is the very foundation of the state's case, and identifying the inconsistencies and discrepancies and errors, omissions and flaws, and showing that their case doesn't make sense because it doesn't reconcile within itself. There's too many inconsistencies and discrepancies where there's, you're showing discrepancies between internal to a witness themselves and multiple communications or, discrepancies between the state's witnesses and other state witnesses or discrepancies between a state's witness and a defense witness and then showing that, let me talk about that one. So let's say you have a state witness and a defense witness and all things being equal, most people in our business would say, well, that's a wash. Well, why are you allowing that to be a wash? What if your investigation were able to show that the state's witness lacked credibility because you can impeach what they're saying on multiple levels? You may be able to show that, a lot of what they're giving you is opinion. And one of the things I teach is to separate fact from opinion. And I always say, what's a fact? A fact is subject to verification. An opinion is not. People bleed them together. You know, most witnesses and most interviewers will allow a witness to just put a bunch of information together, and it's a big mix of fact and fiction. You know,
true.
And when you mix opinions with facts, it lends credibility to the fiction. It really does. And we've got some great exercises in the training that I do to show that, to clearly demonstrate, look at this. And most people go, oh, wow, yeah. You know, it's funny. You know, I just did you might have seen it, because I know you did. I just posted a thing on Facebook regarding my brother, and it was this, I used one of the fake sites of pranks, and it looked like a real, Channel 23 News with a picture of him and an article. I spent some time writing the article that he solved his own murder. He was out in a store, and he heard people planning it. I was shocked how many people believed it.
Investigators
believed it?
Investigators. And that was, you know, we had some discussion before we started this. And again, I appreciate you being on. And sometimes, and they're great friends and they're great investigators, but and you mentioned, you know, your three P's. And when you were telling me those, and we've talked about them before, but I was thinking about some of these people who, you know, they have their biases or their experiences or whatever the case may be, that truly influences their conclusions they come up with, factual or not. And you and I both and the people we work with, whether we're talking about something as common as an event in our neighborhood to our kids, you know, your kids, my grandkids, in school or something, you know, we can still look at everything objectively. And people will come to us because we're able to do that without, I mean, we might have an opinion, but if somebody says, hey, you know, what do you think about that? I'll say, well, you know, my experience or my opinion. But then again, on the other hand, you know, maybe you don't want to follow my own experience because maybe it wasn't so good.
And then don't you often find, I found myself, I'm often frustrating people because when they come to me thinking they might know something about me, or they know me, even if they're a family member, and they think I'm going to automatically side with them, and then I give information to support their claim, but say, on the other hand, they have a point, and you can see them get mad at you.
Right.
It's like, well, there is a point to this, you know, and I walk away going, I don't know what to tell you. It's both sides have merit, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know what to tell you.
I might agree with one more than the other, but they both have,
sometimes
a good foundation, and
it is.
You know, from there it might become personal. You know, how do you personally feel about it?
That's a case, right? Sometimes a case, both the defense and the prosecution has merit, but at the end of the day, which one has more merit than the other, and that could translate into reasonable doubt. But if those facts are not presented to an attorney to make the argument, that defendant is going to suffer from lack of an effective investigation and due diligence.
They will.
You know, we are an integral, crucial part of that process. We're due process investigators, and we have to expand our knowledge. We have to expand our abilities. We have to learn the Jedi tricks, and that's what I teach. They're Jedi tricks. You know, they're understanding it. You know, understanding evidence at its core, how it's developed, how it's built, understanding the lie, the anatomy of a lie, the different motivations why people lie, and under what circumstances. When is a lie acceptable? When is it not? When is it natural? You know, we can't allow people to say, oh, he's lying because of this. They say, well, people say, oh, the defendant lied. Well, of course he lied. Every person who's falsely is accused of something, their first reaction is to deny it. It's the first thing they're going to do. You know, I even teach people in the interview process. That's why I'm so against people walking into an interview and then turning on a recorder. I go, separate the interview process from the documentation process. You interview first. You reconcile the facts, and then once you're ready to take a statement, if you choose to record it versus taking a work product, you know, report, then you record it. You don't just throw it on and start talking. And
I think that was that was one of the things we touched on as well was, you know, there are investigators that, you know, ask, like you mentioned, 10 questions given by the attorney. And, you know, one of the things they'll do is they'll just turn on the recorder and say, you know, and not even know what's going to be said.
No idea. No idea what that spontaneous comment's going to be that just buried the client. Now there's no way to keep it out of the discovery process. And, you know, and I am – forensic testimony and evidence recovery can be used in any form of legal investigation, interviewing, and fact-gathering. But I do focus it upon criminal defense investigation. And criminal defense and due process has a lot of rules. It has a lot of pitfalls, a lot of mines that you can step on. And, you know, you really have to be on top of your game doing criminal defense because you have a fiduciary duty to that defendant, you know, and to the Constitution of the United States, the Sixth Amendment, to provide a fair, you know, an impartial trial, to make sure they have a fair trial, as well as the Fourth Amendment and Fifth Amendment and the, you know, 14th Amendment. There's so much that we do as criminal defense investigators that has an impact on our society and culture, not just on that particular case, whether someone was in a car accident and they're going to get a sufficient amount of money for the injuries they sustained. It's different.
It impacts
everyone. When you're defending someone's Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial, you're defending your Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. You're defending everyone's Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. That's the nobility of the effort.
And one of the things that you sort of just now touched on is that the FTER method can be used in more than just criminal, but you folks are cool. And, you know, Karen and I are both CCDIs, for our listeners, at Certified Criminal Defense Investigators, which is what you developed in your component method. And I tell people all the time, you know, granted, it might be criminal defense within that certification, that program, but we use it all the time for civil cases as well.
Absolutely.
We use it all the time in our wrongful death case.
That methodology the component method has been adapted by the National Indian Gaming Commission on the federal level for all the casinos in the U.S.
Right.
By the regulated investigators. We've adapted it for a variety of different, you know, regulations and civil investigations. And this method itself, while I do promote it and I do teach it with the slant of criminal defense, it is applicable when you learn it. At a minimum, a person's going to walk away. I'm not going to teach little tricks to get people to say what you need them to say. What we're going to teach in the class is mostly that you have a deeper understanding of evidence itself and how it is formed in the human mind and how that experience is translated to another person and how it's received by another person and how it's communicated. You know, one of the things I always say is think about this for a moment. It really can lay it out simply. When we experience an event, we process that information and then through a variety of filters, as we said, the three Ps, and then we interpret what we see. We use the references we have available to us, and everybody's references are different based on experience, education, how well-traveled they are, how diverse in cultures they've experienced. We're limited, okay? And then we come to a conclusion. Now, someone comes along to you and says, tell me what happened. You are immediately forced to edit your experience so you can reduce it to words, right? You have to. No one can effectively put into words the wholeness of their experience in life or even a single event. There's too much information. There's too much data. So they reduce it to words. Then they may say, okay, I need you to write that down. So now you edit again and you reduce it to writing. So it could go through multiple editing stages just at the individual who has the experience and is attempting to communicate it based upon what the interviewer does. And if the interviewer interviews them in a classic incorrect style, such as loaded questions or true and false or multiple choice, now they're forcing editing on that witness and forcing them to only answer in a certain way. So there's a lot of things that can go bad in an interview if you don't understand evidence and how you should be collecting it, just like you do in forensic science. Same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Well, I mean, one of the simple analogies we get, you know, in circumstantial evidence is, you know, a guy's in a cabin, it snowed out, and there's animal tracks out in front. So the conclusion is, based on his, you know, when you go ask him what happened, he'll say, well, a rabbit crossed in front of the cabin. And some people will ask a few simple questions, you know, when did that happen or something, but they don't take it to find out, how does the guy know, you know, and I know you're going to cover a very detailed, but I'm just simplifying things, but, you know, how do you know it was a rabbit? How do you know when it did it? How do you know what was going on? How do you know what direction it went? You know, how do you know there wasn't an animal that drugged the rabbit? Well, those questions are answered in the proper interview. I didn't see any other tracks. I know what a rabbit track looks like. It didn't start snowing until after I went to bed, and I went to bed at 10 o'clock, you know, things like that.
Exactly.
So, you know, we take a very simple, what is, quote, circumstantial evidence, which is what most things are. There's very little direct evidence anymore, just in the process. So we take all that circumstantial evidence. We need to find out how factual it is, how reliable that witness is. And I know you mentioned that before. That's one of the things we cover, you know, in this learning process. This FTER is also going to be, how do we know that that person we're interviewing is reliable? You just covered a whole bunch of it, you know, in that short amount of time.
Yeah, and the best way to impeach a witness is not a background investigation. The best way to impeach a witness is during your interview process, let them impeach themselves.
Right.
That's the best way.
No. It is, yeah. It is, absolutely. So we're coming up to the end of our time here. Time goes fast, Brandon. Sorry, but you've covered so much. Before we go, I'm going to cover a little bit about the training opportunities coming up, and then I want to give you some closing thoughts and share some contact information one more time for our listeners so they have another chance to write it down. So this is that time when our listeners need to get their pen and pencil ready one more time. But the FTER, the Forensic Testimonial Evidence Recovery Training, will be a one-day training that will include certification. It will be held in Colorado on September 14th, and then following that will be the regular conference. Now, your component is a pre-conference, and there is a separate fee for our listeners. They need to understand this. If they're a PPIC or an NCISS member or one of the other friends of PPIC, their fee for that day is $175. Otherwise, it's $275. And I know you mentioned that that's a world of a bargain, because normally it's $275 and up, just for even with a discount. So they really need to attend this. Stay for the conference. The conference isn't that much more for the next 2 days. Hotel rooms are available, but our listeners can learn more information about the training opportunity and the PPIC conference at www.ppiac.org. And again, that's ppiac.org for Professional Private Investigators of Colorado. And Brandon, I really appreciate, I know you did this as a favor to me, as well as other people out here in Colorado, to come out here and do this, but we talked a lot. You were excited to do it. I really want to extend my gratitude for that. And, you know, really, thank you very much for that.
No problem. I think I get 2 hours credit because I'm 2 hours behind, so it's actually like 2 hours credit for talking to you today, right? So
okay. I think that's the way that works. That's right. That's the way we'll do that. I know you've shared a lot about your passion for doing this, and I think anybody that knows you or knows about you is going to quickly realize that they're going to get a lot of powerful, energetic information in a short amount of time that will, the way I see it is, you can spend 8 hours gaining something that you're going to be able to bill out easily above what you're going to pay. You're going to use this information for years to come. It's going to expand on how you do any of your investigative tasks, from interviews to analysis of records and reports. I think it's going to be fascinating. The book is fascinating. So with that, I want you to share with our listeners one more time, who have their pen and paper ready, how they can reach you. And we didn't cover before, but how can they find out how to order a book? I know, remind me, is the book included? No, the book is not included in the fee when they come out here, but they will need to buy the book. So they
yeah,
can
they can buy
it
there.
Bring it with
you. I believe you can buy it there, and you're going to be able to buy it probably cheaper there. And you can purchase the book at Amazon.com. It's
okay.
You know, by myself, Brandon A. Perrin, Forensic Testimonial Evidence Recovery.
Okay.
The FTER method. But the book will, I believe, it's going to be, if I'm not mistaken, $20 per book at the event. We're going to have books there, so I would recommend that they, if they want it, they can purchase in advance from Amazon, and it's going to be, they're going to pay about $8 to $9 more, I believe, or they can purchase it as a discount at the event. So
okay.
That may be what they want to do. If they're interested, they can go to our website, and that'll bring a link to there as well. It's cditctraining.com, cditctraining.com, or publicdefenderinvestigator.com. It's both the same site, publicdefenderinvestigator.com.
Great. And I'll put this information in the show notes with the PPIC link, the conference link, registration. I'll even include a link to Amazon, to the Amazon book. I'll put to them. And what's the best way for them to reach you by phone and by email if you wish?
You want to call 1-800-465-5233, 1-800-465-5233, or they can email me at investigator.perrin@gmail.com, investigator.perrin@gmail.com.
That's great, Brandon. I appreciate it very much. For our listeners, please take advantage of everything that Brandon has shared with us today. It truly is, I have the book, I've read the book, but I have not taken the training. I've long used some of the components through other experiences, but I'm really looking forward to this because I know Karen and I are both going to learn quite a bit, and we think it's important to us, so I'm asking our listeners to join us. Brandon, thank you very much, my friend, for joining me again. I look forward to seeing you in September. But thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Before we say goodbye, here are some important traits of a professional investigator, whether you are a fellow investigator or looking to retain one. Quintessential qualities of a professional investigator. Skills appropriate for the assignment. Experience and knowledge. Responsible and ethical conduct. Effective communication. Keyword, professional. Honesty, integrity, and intelligence. These define professional investigators and gives you the confidence that your case is in competent and skilled hands.
Well, thank you for joining us for this special Facts and Forensics. Special thanks to my wife and her always welcome conversations with Karen and our special guests that we had. Please visit GIMG.TV for my co-host Tim O'Rourke with PI Insights, Rory McMahon with PI Hotline, and Rich Harris joins us for our monthly roundtable, which is always some interesting shows and discussions. Again, you can reach us in our Colorado number, 970-480-7793, our Wyoming number, 307-222-0136, and, of course, our website with our email address is at deathexperts.com. Thank you very much. I'm Dean Beers, your host. I look forward to talking to you next time.
When you need facts and information about forensics, you need Dean Beers, a recognized private investigator, speaker, author, and your host for Facts and Forensics. We'll be right back.